From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at the Metropolitan Opera in New York in 1903. The Met staged an opera by Ethel Smith called Dervald. It was the first time the Met had ever staged an opera by a woman. So how is this for progress? The next time the Met staged an opera by a woman would come in 1916. What is it? Brenda, what is it? 1916? Oh, it's 2016. My notes are wrong. It's 113 years later. And that sparked this headline in the Huffington Post. The opera world must and can do better. So let's broaden our view to philharmonic orchestras and classical music programming. Where are the women? More than one major American orchestra is heading into their next season without a single woman on the list of conductors or composers. Now, we should keep in mind that most, if not all, of the programming was selected before the October story on Harvey Weinstein broke the dam on a new movement. And that is not to excuse anything, just to point out that change is now happening at a brisk pace. Inclusion and representation are moving higher on the list of programming requirements or desires. The Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra is getting ready for its next season, and its plans do include a woman composer, Jennifer Higdon. This hour, it's a conversation about programming choices, representation, and we'll enjoy hearing some clips for what is coming our way with their next season. My guests include, in studio, Ward Stair, who is just back, not from 1903, but from the Met. And Ward is back from the Met, and it's great to have the music director of the RPO back here, but let me ask you, how are you doing after going to the Met, Ward?
Oh, it's great. It's the afterglow will last, I think, for months and months. It's a pretty fantastic experience. It's a wonderful house.
A tremendous achievement, and Rochester very proud. Great to have you back here. Thank you. Kurt Long is the president and CEO of the RPO. Great to have you, Kurt. Nice having you in studio here for the first time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And Brenda Tremblay is morning host on Classical 91.5 and producer of the RPO broadcast. Do you want to just do this? I've already screwed up enough.
No, how about I just do this? I just wanted to point out that I was doing my laundry listening to Ward conduct at the Metropolitan Opera, and I was one of millions of people around the world just going, yay, it's Ward Stair at the Metropolitan Opera. It was so thrilling for us, everyone in Rochester, for
thank
sure.
You. Big thrill. So thank you.
Yeah.
Do you want me to just get out of the way?
Okay. So this is, we'll start out talking about women in music, first of all, because it's a, kind of a passion of mine. I used to be the classical music writer for City Newspaper, and about 10 years ago, I met Sylvie Boudet, who teaches at the Eastman School of Music. And at that time, she was conducting this fascinating experiment with her students at Eastman in a music history class, and she was playing pieces of music back-to-back by two contemporary composers from different eras and asking her students to write a paragraph about whether the piece of music sounded masculine or feminine, and why. So it was like the Coke versus Pepsi test, you know, trying to figure out which is which. So I thought we could do that here.
I think we're gonna see if we have some of those clips here coming up here, because I know you sent like three. Oh, we've got them, Rob. Okay, so let's just listen to the first one, I think, Rob.
Okay, so. Yeah. Well, let me just set this up here. These are two Baroque composers. One is named Elisabeth de la Guerre. The other one is named Johann Sebastian Bach. One is super famous, one is not. Can you tell the difference?
Rob is still looking, trying to figure out which
clip. Oh, it's number one.
The first clip.
Number one.
That's not helping, Rob.
Okay.
We're going to figure out what here.
All right. We'll
this train's going off the tracks early.
Yeah. Anyway.
She's looking at
the
list now.
Those are different. I'm sorry, Rob. I thought you would have the stuff. I can get the things to him. Do you want me to run it?
Okay, yeah. Let's do this. Brenda's going to make sure we've got those clips. And let me back up and ask our guests in studio this here. I'm curious to know, Ward Stair, you came back to Rochester here at the RPO in 2014. So it's been less than 4 years. Is there more conversation now about does our season include women, people of color, et cetera, than there was even 3-4 years ago?
Well, it's certainly a topic which has very much been brought to the forefront, you know, in all walks of life these days. But we at the RPO have been talking about it for much longer. And one thing that, and Kurt and I talk about this a lot together, one thing that I think is important for any orchestra in any city is to look at what makes your city special and how we can make connections to the history of a city. And of course, here in Rochester, Susan B. Anthony is a major part of our history and something that we're all very proud of. And that's just one example. So something that we've already been talking about actually quite a lot is the approaching 100-year anniversary of suffrage in 1919, which will be next season, or the 1920 season, actually, and making kind of a big deal about that to capitalize on our history. But, so we have the advantage of that really rich tradition here in Rochester, and it's something that we're very proud of, and we want to see it reflected in how the RPO is programming.
Okay. Kurt, are you noticing in the industry just sort of nationwide more of an emphasis, more of a conversation, whether it's in the last few months, the last year, the last 5 years, and we'll focus on women in particular, women conducting / composing?
I would say that there is a change, and I think it's actually been going on for longer than that, but it's kind of a very slow but inexorable change, which is coming to orchestras. And the way I look at it is orchestras, our whole business model was built around the idea that everybody in our audience is going to sign up for the whole season, and that our job was to program a season to make this one group of people happy. And while we all still have subscribers and we love our subscribers and we want to try to sell as many subscriptions as we can, I think the reality for orchestras across the country and around the world is that most people are not going to sign up for a season, and they're going to kind of pick and choose concerts that look interesting to them. And so for orchestras, I think in a way that's very, it's liberating. And to succeed and thrive in the future, we're going to have to do lots of different kinds of concerts aimed at lots of different kinds of audiences, instead of thinking there's one monolithic audience that has one set of taste of one kind of music they want to hear, and our job is to make them happy.
Okay, but have you seen anything change since the Weinstein stuff hit? Because I think now it's not a question just of trying to understand what's happening in terms of sexual harassment, but also representation about elevating voices, et cetera. Any change since October, Kurt?
Well, I think there certainly is more attention being paid to orchestra seasons, and there are people who are calling out orchestras when they're not happy with what they're seeing. I do think it's a valid point that orchestra seasons are planned long in advance and move slowly, and they don't turn on a dime. And so I suspect we'll see more change coming for the following year that maybe reflects people being serious about these issues that are being raised.
Okay, Brenda?
I was just going to say, I'm sure that the administration of the Philadelphia Orchestra wishes they had a crystal ball about 2 years ago when they started planning their season, because it's really embarrassing to, you know, present a new season with no women. The same is true for the Metropolitan and the Houston Grand Opera as well. So I think there are a lot of organizations that are kind of wishing they had anticipated this movement, and it's going to be exciting. It's going to be an exciting voyage of discovery, I think. I want to say, too, the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra has been in the forefront of this movement in the past. Not long ago, there were at least one or two seasons where there was a piece of music by a woman composer included in every single concert. It was a little problematic, a little inconvenient, a little expensive, but it was wonderful. Mona Segetola-Slami and I were talking about our journey of discovery, listening to those pieces that we had never heard before, discovering Margaret Rauer and Karen Tanaka and all these women composers we had never heard of, and we're in the business. So I'm hoping, you know, maybe that in general orchestras will kind of move in that direction.
Is there, Brenda, when you kind of see what what's happening across the country, is there sort of a head-scratching moment when Philadelphia or other orchestras roll out their next season and there are no women conducting or composing?
Yeah, I think it's just, it's not top of mind. I think it's not the first thing people are thinking of when they're putting together an orchestra season. You know, they're talking, okay, what solo, you guys are the experts here. What soloists do you want? What does your audience want to hear? What will sell tickets? I mean, those are the kinds of questions you're asking, right?
They are, and our business runs on selling tickets and on balancing how much it costs to put on concerts with how much revenue we can produce and making our sponsors happy and our donors happy. And I do think that there is a move towards doing a lots of different variety of program, and much of the variety is happening outside of the main subscription series. So I think if you look at the Philadelphia Orchestra, I bet they will have concerts that have music by women composers, but they're just not on the main subscription series.
And mm-hmm. Meanwhile, L.A. and other places are really emphasizing this, right, Brenda?
Absolutely. The Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra just kind of rocked the world by announcing their upcoming season. I think they have 22 world premieres, or 22 pieces of music by women composers, and many, many world premieres by women composers. And it's kind of a change there where they want to reflect the culture of Los Angeles and the culture of California as much as anything. And I think, again, Ward, you and Kurt would be the experts on this, but the woman who engineered that change at the LA Phil is now in New York, mm-hmm. at the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, trying to do the same thing, make the New York Philharmonic Orchestra kind of a mirror to the community and all of its diversity. And, you know, just to take the bird's eye view, I think it was on National Public Radio right before the election last year. There was a report on the demographics of this country, and a child who is brown in a preschool right now will be in the majority in the United States within a generation. And how is that reflected in our major institutions and our cultural institutions? I think here in Rochester, the Memorial Art Gallery has done a lot to get in the front of that, to reflect the culture of the city and what Rochester looks like. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for other organizations to get on board with that.
Okay, and so before we hear this clip now, which is going to be there, and then we're going to talk Jennifer Higdon, which I know there's a lot of excitement about, I want to ask Warden Kurt if they think these kind of questions are fair. I mean, Kurt, you said people around the country are looking at these seasons that are rolling out, and they are kind of saying, hey, you've got this but not this, or how come this isn't represented? Are those fair questions, Kurt?
I think they are absolutely fair questions. I think running an orchestra and programming a season is complicated, and we have constituencies that we have to make happy, and we have constituencies that buy tickets, and orchestras that ignore what their audience is looking for do it at their peril. But I think we have to embrace the we have to recognize that actually the audience is not monolithic, and there are different parts of the audience looking for different things.
And you don't want the audience to be monolithic.
We do not.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as I said, it's kind of liberating to realize we can. We have different people out there that are looking for different things. And if we're creative about coming up with programs that appeal to a broad range of audiences, we can reach lots of people and sell lots of tickets and make the business thrive.
Well, your movie series has been incredibly successful. Didn't you have to add a performance of E.T. last year? Was it you had sold
out? I think that might be right. Yeah, that's been a great entree sort of for a lot of new faces, new audience members to hear the orchestra. And I think to your point about it being a valid conversation, absolutely. And I actually am excited whenever something in current events can be applicable to what we do in the orchestral world, because there's still this preconceived notion, you know, that we're this sort of living museum to all these things that happened hundreds of years ago and is not current and not valid and not, you know, relevant today. And we are. And so this gives us an opportunity to be a part of the conversation in a very meaningful way.
I guess the question I would ask you guys is this happen organically? Are you just kind of letting diversity into the programming as things go along? Or is it time to start shoehorning things in and being deliberate and intentional about including diverse pieces of music?
I don't think you ever have to shoehorn, because one of the great things about our industry is there's so much music. I mean, you were just talking about the pieces that you discovered when we had that theme a few seasons ago. It's great. There's so much great music out there. Those of us who do the research with everything that gets put into a season, you know, have maybe a little bit more work to do digging a little bit deeper, but you don't have to sacrifice quality in order to include a diverse repertoire on a season, because there's so much great music.
Well, we're about to, I think, prove that point in just a second here. I do wonder, Ward, when you're putting programming together, if I remember years ago, we're going to bring this back to, of all people, David Spade. David Spade said that he went to see REM, and REM said, we got a bunch of new stuff to play. And he said, I paid $60 for a ticket to hear you play Shiny Happy People. Let's hear it. You know, and I wonder if there is a temptation that, well, we've got to work Beethoven or Mozart or something into every season, that there is, we know if we did the ninth, Beethoven's ninth, we're going to sell it out, and it's not going to be difficult to move that needle. And let's face it, in the classical world, there are white men who get most of the attention. And so the quality of composers of color, women, is less known. Therefore, it's maybe a harder sell, not because of the quality, just because of how it's known. And is there pressure to sort of program what's better known?
Well, there's always the pressure of the box office and the ticket sales, because you want people in the hall. So, of course, that's a consideration. But there are a lot of ways that you can achieve diversity on a program. I mean, speaking specifically about female composers, it must have been last year or the year before, they sort of run together sometimes in my mind. But I remember we programmed a piece by Stephanie Berg, who's a wonderful young American composer. And I put it on a program on the first half, a shorter piece, Ravish and Mayhem was what it was called. You remember that, Brenda?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's a cool piece.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was on with Strauss's Ein Heldenleben. So it gave the core audience who are used to and expecting, you know, the canon, like the REM story you just told us, it gives them the satisfaction of hearing a great war horse like Ein Heldenleben, but also it broadens their mind and they get to hear a brand new piece. And it just, in that case, happened to be by a female composer, and it's all great music. So it's not an impossible task.
It's not a perfect analogy either, because the Ninth is not shiny, happy people. For people.
For some people, it is, actually. For some people.
Let's listen to the clip that Brenda was talking about, just because I think this is an interesting little thought experiment.
All right, so I don't want to put anybody on the spot except you, Evan. So we'll play this cut. These are two Baroque composers.
We promised there would be no quizzes.
One is by Bach, and one is by a woman composer living at the very same time as Johann Sebastian Bach. So this is Man versus Woman number one. What do you think? There's our exercise in deep listening for today.
So you're not going to like my answer, but I'm going to justify it, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to answer with a non-answer because we had a really good conversation about what modern feminism means last week and how so often we assume something is biological when it is more culturally sort of just embedded and reinforced. And biological differences are small and society is a microphone and a megaphone that sort of echoes it and amplifies it. And I think wonderful music of all different sort of stereotypical male and aggressive or stereotypically female and sensual is baloney. I think men and women can compose and do compose from all different stylistic choices. You could find Shostakovich in something that is hard-edged and gritty, and you can find Shostakovich that just feels like a waltz on your soul, and it's the same guy. So I don't think there is a good answer for that.
That sounds like a cop-out.
It is a cop-out. So I'll say man one, woman two, but I don't really know why, because I don't think that plays that game.
You guys have any guesses?
I was thinking maybe the opposite. Two was Bach, and one was the one that I'm not familiar with, but I'm not sure. I could be totally wrong.
Any guess?
I would probably say one male, two female.
Yeah, actually, you're right. So the first piece was by Johann Sebastian Bach. The second piece was by a French woman composer who worked in the French courts and was highly successful, Jacqueline de la Guerre. So that was two Baroque composers side by side. And could you really tell the difference? No, I certainly. If I were just driving down the road right now listening to this.
But that's the point. And Ward, don't you think if you wanted to, and we're about to kind of broaden out and just take a look at what RPO's got coming up in the next season, because I mentioned Shostakovich. Ward knows I always get excited when you program Shostakovich. But there's a real peril here in assuming that men and women would compose in any different way that's distinctive to gender.
That's right. And it's actually a ridiculous thing to think, because music is music, and you know there's so much. You know, a good example is Mahler, because Alma Mahler, his wife, was a brilliant musician in her own right, and unfortunately, when they got married, there's this very famous story about how he told her she had to, you know, sideline her career because there's only room for one Mahler, one musician Mahler in a family, which, you know, it's another era, it's another time. I don't want to pass judgment on that one way or the other, because I'm a big Mahler fan, but I think it's a shame that he stifled her creativity. That being said, she still wrote music that exists today, and I've heard some of her songs, and they're beautiful. And so to make the point about masculine versus feminine genetics and music making, you listen to some songs by Alma Mahler, and they could have been written by Gustav. And Gustav wrote some of the most beautiful, if you want to call it feminine, music that's ever been. I mean, think about the Adagietto. It's so tender, so soft, so loving. And, you know, people who don't know anything about music who want to put it in these little categories might say, well, that's a feminine way you could characterize the Adagietto as feminine.
Oh, it's vulnerable.
But it's very right. But it's written by Gustav, and actually, some of Alma's songs are not vulnerable at all. She's very tough, you know, in the way the music is written and also the text. So, That's really anyone who thinks they can categorize music as masculine or feminine. I mean, it's rubbish.
It's a false choice. There you go. Well, let's listen to some Jennifer Higdon, and I want Brenda Tremblay to tell us what we're going to be hearing here in this clip, because it's not necessarily what you're going to be hearing in the season.
Well, first of all, congratulations. The Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra is getting ready to make a commercial recording of Jennifer Higdon's harp concerto with a very famous harpist, Yolanda Codonesis.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer Higdon is one of the leading composers in America right now. And she grew up, I think, in Philadelphia or Baltimore, and she grew up listening to Beatles music. So a lot of her music is kind of infused with all the music that we all grew up listening to, pop music, friendly music. And she's written some fantastically and wildly imaginative pieces. So what we're going to hear now is called Blue Cathedral. We'll just hear about 30 seconds of it. It's with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spano. Blue Cathedral, and that's the same composer that wrote the harp concerto that you guys are premiering in a few weeks.
All right, so tell us what's coming up with Jennifer Higdon. Ward.
Well, the brand new harp concerto, and it's a great honor for any orchestra anytime you get to do a world premiere. So this will be the first performance. You'll hear it right here in Rochester, and Jennifer will be in town with us during the rehearsal process, which is a thrill to be able to work with the composer in the house as we put it together. And it's a project that we're all really excited about.
What is it like when the composer is alive and you can talk to the composer? Because much of your season, you don't get that opportunity. Is that thrilling? Is there more pressure? Is there more interaction that tells you, my interpretation was this, and you get to kind of get to hear exactly what the composer is thinking?
Well, it's a direct collaboration where, you can only guess at what Mahler or Mozart or Beethoven might have wanted. And if you read accounts of some of these, composers from years and years and years ago, you know that the performances would always vary widely. And a lot of composers out of a certain era, like Haydn, for example, even Mozart, sometimes less Beethoven, but they wouldn't put all the information in the score because there were things that were implied and that the musicians would just do naturally. And so there was always flexibility, but somehow we got into this mode where we think that there's just one way to approach a piece, which is also ridiculous. But see, you can have these philosophical discussions with people when you're doing a composer from 200 years ago, but when the composer is standing right there with you, you can just turn around and say, what do you think about moving this a little bit? And they can say, no, that ruins this whole section, or that's a great idea. And so it's really amazing to just have that resource and to create it together, really.
Great stuff. Well, I want to get a phone call here. By the way, rpo.org, if you want to take a look at their plans for the 96th RPO season, rpo.org. Let me grab Mike in Geneva. Go ahead, Mike.
First off, I wanted to thank the RPO for everything that they do for our community upstate. I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience watching classical symphony orchestras. I was lucky in high school to have a fine arts program that took us to operas. I've seen the RPO on many occasions. Luckily, that was something that I couldn't afford to do on my own. But the first time that I can remember actually knowingly see a female composed and a female conducted piece was actually very recently. I went and saw a program called Video Games Live, and I believe the RPO is probably pretty familiar with that, but I saw video game music orchestrated and composed by a local orchestra. And I just wanted to know what you thought about the importance of including programming like E.T., movies, video games to try to bring in the younger generation, which you know, happens to also bring in the inclusiveness, young women, people of color, and other programming like that. That's not necessarily Bach, Beethoven, but other things that to capture the younger audience and bring them into something that they may have never experienced before.
Mike, thanks very much.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mike, I sang in that concert, or the final, was it the Final Fantasy? I can't remember what the video game was. I'm going to betray my ignorance. But it was so much fun because we were shouting in these, like, Moon Man fake fairy languages. You know, you could tell I don't play video games. It was so much fun. And the hall was packed. I think it's great.
Kurt and Ward, you want to jump in there, too?
Sure. Yeah. I think... playing, again, that's part of a general move towards thinking about diverse programming to reach diverse audiences, and video games are a massive business that attract a massive audience, and music is an important part of video games, and there's symphonic music for video games out there, and of course we should be playing it. It draws an audience, and it delivers, the orchestra does it well for an audience that really enjoys it, and we've now been doing that for the last, I think, 3 or 4 seasons at the RPO, and we draw a different audience, and it is incredibly enthusiastic.
And it's a wonderful opportunity to give, to break down the barriers again and have that common element, because I think one thing that stops people from coming to see their local symphony orchestra more times than not is that they just feel completely at a distance and alienated from what we do. And so if they see, oh, that's a film that I know, okay, I'm familiar with that, that'll make me comfortable, so I'll go to this event, or I play that video game, wow, that's kind of cool, let's check this out. And then when they get in the hall, I think people become, especially when it comes to the films, they become more aware of how critical the music actually is to the drama, and hearing it performed live is pretty cool, you know, right in front of you. And I always say, I don't care how awesome your sound system is at home, there's nothing to replace the experience of seeing a movie with the soundtrack being performed live in front of you. It's incredible.
All right, so that's all. I appreciate that, Mike. And again, that's all part of their efforts to broaden that scope of the audience for the RPO. After our break, we're going to talk a lot more and hear more clips of the music that you can experience from RPO's upcoming season, 2018-2019. The full season, you can find it on rpo.org. I want to bring in real briefly Rob Diemer, who is with the American Council on Education and with the School of Music at the State University of New York at Fredonia, SUNY Fredonia, who has created... Well, Rob, first of all, thanks for taking the time to join us. Tell us what you have created.
Sure. Hi there, and thank you again for having me.
Yeah.
Basically, over the last year and a half, myself initially and then with some help from our students here at State University of New York in Fredonia, we've put together a database, a browsable database of women composers, both living and dead, that currently encompasses about 3,100 composers all over the country with many, many different genres, and it's searchable by genre, by race, by location, it's basically to create a tool with which conductors and performers can search for composers that they may not know about and hopefully discover some more music for them to program.
How difficult was it to be as comprehensive as you have been on this, Rob?
It was somewhat difficult. There's actually a fair amount of lists of composers, especially women composers, out there. But the problem is that most of the lists are just that, they're lists. And so if you want to actually discover, if you're looking, say, to find women composers who have written music for, you were just talking about video games, you'd have to go through each individual website to be able to discover who's doing it. By using this searchable database, it allows folks to be able to just look, you know, isolate the search down to a particular genre.
Rob, why did you decide to take on this project now, at this particular time?
Sure. Well, actually, I was writing for New Music Box, which is an online magazine affiliated with the American Composers Forum and New Music USA. About 5 years ago, I wrote an article basically talking about the idea that I've heard a lot of conductors say that they would love to be able to program more women composers, but they just don't know who they are or where to find them. And so I came up with an initial list of about 200 composers that I knew about through my own work. and just wrote the article and said, hey, here you go. Here's the hyperlinked website of them. And then about a year and a half ago, I went back to that article, and there was about 400 more composers in the comments that folks had suggested. And so I took all of those names, put it into a spreadsheet, and just as I was putting that together, I'm like, wait a minute, I could easily make this into a usable tool. And then it just kind of went from there.
Well, this is a nice little coda on the first half here. Brenda, you want to jump in?
Hi, Rob. This is Brenda Trombley. I'm the morning host on Classical 91.5. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were about why women were chronically underrepresented on stage, like why this music isn't being performed more. Why?
Well, that's a good question with a lot of layers to it. I think it's a combination of, it's easy for folks to say that there just weren't as many women composers, especially pre, say, middle of the 20th century. And I think probably the data would bear that out, that there's just not as many women composers because they weren't encouraged, because they were actually discouraged. But there's also, there's way more women composers out there than people know about. And it's the knowing about them that I think is the real issue. Just recently, there's been a flurry of interest and activity on the composer, African-American female composer, Florence Price, out of articles that have been written in The New Yorker and elsewhere, and her works have been programmed. And I think the more both critics and journalists write about and musicologists write about these composers, and then conductors and performers strive to include them into their programming, the more the audiences are going to start recognizing the names, and then they will become a more stable part of the canon.
Well, the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra played a concerto by Florence Price a few seasons ago, I think, with Terrence Wilson, mm-hmm. the concerto in one mm-hmm. movement. Yeah.
And so here's a tweet from one of our listeners who says, Evan, I'm a Choose Your Own season subscriber to the RPO. I was delighted to see a woman on the list, and I'll be seeing that program for sure. So a lot of interest in what's happening here and with this field across the country. So, Rob, if people want to see what you've put together, where can they do that?
That's a good question, because we have the database up on a Google site, but it's not really we're actually working on creating a website. It literally just went live back in December. But basically, if they go to my Twitter handle, just at Rob Deamer on Twitter, they'll be able to find a link to the database. And then once we get a fully formed website up, they'll be able to find it there too.
Thanks for taking the time, Rob. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again.
You bet.
Rob Deamer from the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia, and again, that list on his Twitter handle. Got to get a snappy website for it if people want to find it.
But, absolutely.
All right, so let's get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we've got clips from Mahler and Shostakovich and a lot more to talk about with the RPO's next season, 2018-2019. Ward Stair, the music director, is here. Kurt Long, the president and CEO of the RPO, is here. And Brenda Trombley, the morning host for Classical 91.5 and producer of the RPO broadcast, is here. We continue after this break. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. What is Rock the Riverway? $50 million in state money, lots of development ideas for Rochester's Riverway. What should it look like? The people in charge tell us what they're thinking about for Rock the Riverway. Then in our second hour, a movement to end solitary confinement. What are the arguments for and against it? We will discuss it. Talk to you Thursday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Brenda Trombley wants to jump in with something here before we move on to other pieces the RPO's got planned.
I know. This has been such a great conversation. I'm so excited about the upcoming RPO season. Just a quick note that it is Women's History Month on Classical 91.5, and you can dig really deep into the lives of all these women composers on our website, classical915.org. And there's a free concert this weekend at the Women's Rights National Historical Park featuring a group that has been touring the United States, and they're going to be playing music by Amy Beach and Joan Tower, a brand new condition commission called Solitude of Self. It's part of the Music in the American Wild Project at the Women's Hall of Fame. That's taking place on March 3rd, Saturday, 2:30 p.m., and that is free in the Wesleyan Chapel on Fall Street in Seneca Falls.
Okay, and Rob Diemer, who you just heard from SUNY Fredonia, who created that database for women composers, is writing a blog post for WXXI and for Classical 91.5, and you can find that on classical915.org coming up here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. So that's all happening this month, and all happening in the 2018-2019 season is, well, a lot with the RPO. And Ward, I'm going to ask you the most unfair question I can. If you had, if someone told you you were only going to be healthy enough to do one performance, what are you most excited about in the 2018-2019 season?
What an awful question.
I know. I told you. it's totally unfair.
Well, I'm going to go with the program that we're recording live for with the Jennifer Higdon, and we have music from Leonard Bernstein, Patrick Harlan on that same program, because it's a great opportunity for the orchestra to capture this world premiere.
Okay, I would have gone with Shostakovich. That's just me. let's go ahead and let's listen to a little bit of Shostakovich 10 here, and then we'll talk about it. Says anything to you, it probably is saying to you that a dictator has just died and I can finally tell you everything I've wanted to tell you for so long. Is that what it says to you, Ward Stair?
Well, this piece has got so many layers to it. One thing that's worth noting is that Shostakovich was known for putting his initials into his music. So, ba-dee-da-da, it's D-S-C-H, right.
Yeah.
And there's a passage toward the end of the symphony where you hear these notes repeated over and over and over and over again. And it's almost like Shostakovich is, you know, in his home looking in the mirror, repeating his own. I read this somewhere in an analysis that I thought was brilliant. He's trying to reassert the fact that he is a person, he is a man, by repeating his initials over and over again, because one of the many awful things that Stalin did to Shostakovich and others was they would be declared a non-person, if you can believe that. And so this is him saying, no, I am a person, I am here, I am valid. And so it's got this tremendous determination that just permeates the entire work. It's extraordinarily powerful.
I think written in 1953?
Yes.
And Stalin died in March of that year. And I know there's some debate about when, you know, were parts of this created in the years before.
That's the thing. People, it's like planning a season. You know, Kurt was saying earlier that, you know, these things start a long time before, you know, they're actually heard for the first time or published. And so Shostakovich had no way of knowing that Stalin would die when he did. So we can't say this is a direct reaction to his death. But of course, it was timely.
Is it possible that he was writing something that he knew could be finally performed after Stalin died, and that when you're gone, I will have something to share with the world?
Well, he was one of the amazing things about Shostakovich is if you look at his output and match it up with what was going on in Russia at the time, I mean, he was censored heavily on multiple occasions, mm-hmm. by the regime, and he would react by, you know, the famous story about the Fifth Symphony, of course, which we did last year, which was the answer to the Fourth, which was banned, and they hated it, they didn't get it. This week, we're actually doing the Ninth Symphony, which is another interesting story because, you know, the Ninth, there's this mystique of the Ninth Symphony, right? And the war had just ended, and Stalin and everyone were expecting this grand statement that was going to glorify the Soviet Union for defeating the Nazis and this apotheosis for Stalin and everything. And Shostakovich actually teased it a little bit himself and said, oh, yes, we'll have a great poem, we'll have singers, we'll have a chorus, we'll have a massive orchestra. And so there was this great anticipation. And what he came out with was his smallest symphony. It's practically a chamber symphony, neoclassical in nature. It's about 25 minutes long, give or take. And Shostakovich was just completely irate about it. Stalin, was irate with the result because he expected this Beethoven 9 for Russia, you know, and it was Shostakovich's little way of getting his own dig in. So he had a tremendous amount of strength and integrity in the face of awful oppression.
It is amazing that he was writing with bombs literally going off, you know, in the distance that you could hear, you know. Just amazing what he was able to produce under those circumstances.
The Seventh Symphony, which comes, I mean, the Seventh and the Eighth Symphonies were colossal. And so they thought that the Ninth would be, you know, the cap to this war trilogy. And he threw him a total curveball.
he wrote an opera in the 1930s that nearly got him killed. And so there was real risk for Shostakovich. This is not just a sort of a theoretical. There's real risk. So when you tell somebody, I'm getting you a diamond ring for your birthday, and you get them a Cheerio when they open the box, and they could kill you as a result, there's a real risk there.
You know, he kept a suitcase at the door packed at all times because he never knew when he'd have to flee.
I mean, I don't think that's apocryphal. I think
that's absolutely true. Yes.
So the 10th, Shostakovich's 10th, I don't have the exact date. Do you know the date? I should have the date in front of me. That's on the list.
Next season with the Rock.
Next season.
Yeah, next year. 2018, 2019.
Of course.
March.
But I'd
well,
like
Kurt's
to have
got the
date
have
somewhere.
Right here.
What's
so
the date on that,
March
Kurt?
7 and 9, 2019.
Okay. So you got a year to plan for that. And we're sort of bouncing around a little bit this hour. If you want to see something more linear, go to rpo.org. I also want to ask you, Ward, one of the things that I love about what Ward and what the RPO have really aimed to do, and Jeff Tysik does this so well, is to tell the story of the music. And Ward is a great storyteller, and there's something that connects me so much more when I understand it. I mean, there's something really emotional about Shostakovich's music, even if you don't know the story. But knowing the history matters more to me. Are you going to continue to do the storytelling and the kind of the setup that you do for your members there?
Oh, absolutely. There is always a pre-concert lecture for anyone who's interested for every single Philharmonic.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, if I'm conducting that program, I do it myself, and I'm usually accompanied with our guest artists if they're willing. And when I'm not conducting, we always have the artist giving the talks. Also, so there's always a pre-concert lecture. And whenever I have an opportunity or when I feel that a piece would benefit from a little further explanation for the entire audience, I do tend to speak from the stage. And I've been doing that more and more because I get a lot of good feedback about it. People say, you know, I enjoyed the experience of listening to the piece a lot more because I had context. And I think that's helpful, and it's a valid thing. Sure.
I think it's beautiful, and I want to thank you for doing that for people like me who just soak it up so much more. So that's a great opportunity, and if you end up with tickets on any of these performances, whether it's season tickets or just individual performances, it's a great chance to learn much more about what you're going to hear. Let's listen to a little bit of Mahler 7. We've got so you want to tell us a little before we listen to this one, you want to give us the shortened version of that?
Well, Mahler 7 is kind of like a... It's kind of like the ugly duckling of the Mahler symphonies in a way. It doesn't get programmed very much because it's kind of episodic and fragmented. It's hard to string everything together, but there's a lot of personality in it, and it's the world that Mahler takes you to is, I think, probably more diverse, and there are more twists and turns than in probably any of his other symphonies. So it's a wild ride for sure.
Just a quick question. He was diagnosed with a very serious heart condition at some point in his life. Was he writing this under those circumstances?
Well, Mahler was kind of a hypochondriac, you know, and then when he found out that he had this heart condition, that was very much on his mind. And you know, when he was writing the Sixth Symphony, for example, he was paranoid about the three hammer blows, and he thought his heart would stop if he kept the third in. So it was removed when he performed it, but some people choose to put it in. Then the Seventh Symphony came after that, where I think he was really questioning even more frequently than before his own mortality, you know, things like that. So, yeah, you can hear kind of the psychology, the confusion, and the angst and the urgency in the symphony.
All right, so this is it's really hard to do 45 seconds and really encapsulate.
It's way better than this.
but let's listen to some of Mahler 7.
Thank you.
So, Ward, you want to tell us a little bit more about what you're feeling and hearing here?
Well, just listen to that. That's a great example, though. It's so provocative. Doesn't it make you want to explore more? It's so mysterious. It's haunting. It's a little bit creepy, too. It makes you kind of stir in your seat a little bit because you're wondering, where has he taken us? Where are we right now?
I think one of the pleasures, too, of Mahler is that it's like chamber music. It's mm-hmm. thin, and you can hear individual players. It's mm-hmm. almost like very intimate. And then, you know, the next moment, it's like blasting yeah. brass, and it's just so exciting. So it's very dimensional.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Mahler's 7th. Kurt, do you have the date on that?
That is going to be on February 28th and March 2nd.
So 1 year from now.
A year.
You got a chance to plan for it. That's nice. That's the nice thing about this conversation and what RPO does for you. They give you a chance a year out to really plan, to take a look at the full season. RPO.org, we are just barely scratching the surface. And I think we're going to have a chance not only to hear a little of Così fan tutte, but Brenda Tremblay, Renee Fleming here?
Yes, this is Renee Fleming, and you know, buried in my notes in front of me, which you can't see, this is so embarrassing, is what we're listening to. It's an aria from Act Two, and I think she's sort of apologizing for being fickle in this aria. Ward, you probably know more about it than I do, as soon as you hear it. Confession, when I pulled this music in the studio, I didn't have the heart to stop it. I just let it go for five minutes.
It's so difficult.
And we could do that right now if you like.
It's the last 5 minutes of the program here. Well, Ward, what are we hearing here?
The whole opera is really about love and how fragile it is and how fickle it can be. But at the end, it's a very positive message. See, there are these two couples, and it's this whole game where the guys fake a departure to go off to war, and they say, well, you know, I don't think your girl's going to be faithful to you, and they have this bet. So they come back disguised, and they try to seduce the other's girlfriend, you know, and see who will win. And so nothing too lurid happens or anything like that. It's all very playful. But one ends up being a little more faithful than the other. But at the end, everyone's reunited, and it's been a happy exercise, and it's more playful than anything. It's not really an awful operatic bloody betrayal or anything like that.
Okay, and is there anything subversive in the title? You see, this is in the Me Too moment. I'm hearing the title, and I'm going, oh man. The title means essentially they're all like that, right?
Women are like that.
Women are like that. I mean, I hope there's something subversive that I'm missing here.
No, it's just a line that's in the opera. And that ended up being the title. I don't think it's a larger message.
Okay. Yeah.
What do you love about doing these staged operas? That's a new thing for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra.
It is. Well, I think the way an orchestra has to play when they're playing an opera with voices is just different. There are differences in how we phrase and how we support the singers and how we create the drama for both the story and the music itself. And it's an important tool for any orchestra to have in its bag, so to speak. And it allows us to work with even more great singers than we typically would during a concert season. So there's so many positives to it. And, you know, I've found that our audience really loves that it's a variety from what they're used to hearing on our Phil's series. And I, of course, adore opera, and I conduct a lot of opera, so it's very close and near and dear to my heart as well.
And you're doing a semi-stage Carmen in May, right?
That's right.
So can I just mention here, I mean, if Jeff Tysik were here, we'd have wonderful stories from Jeff as well, but what they got coming up, and we really have barely scratched the surface. I mean, they're going to premiere a new tango concert and a special program about the musical relationship between Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. Don Potter's going to join him for the Holiday Pops. So there's a lot coming up there, rpo.org. Kurt, same question for you. If you can only go to one performance, what's it going to be?
Wow. Well, I think probably it would have to be The Rite of Spring. So that is such an amazing piece that changed music and an amazing live experience, and I'm really looking forward to having that on our season next year.
All right. So Before I go here, I want to turn back to Ward, because we mentioned the fact that Ward was just at the Met, conducting at the Met, which is a tremendous honor and achievement for anyone from anywhere. And so that gives Rochester a lot of pride. For you, was there a singular moment that you, because I want to believe that you walked out there and there was never any nerves and it was easy, but was there a moment where you finally felt like, all right, my feet are under me and this is happening, this is real?
Well, the first day that I met the orchestra was a key moment, obviously, and you know, it's one of the best orchestras on the planet, quite literally, and so getting to work with them was an extraordinary experience. And it's interesting, a lot of people don't realize this, but the Met, because it's such an enormous operation and they do so much repertoire in any given week, they actually have almost two full orchestras on staff and they rotate. So throughout the run, I did 9 performances, and I had different people in different chairs throughout the course. And so I would come into the pit, you know, every night, and the orchestra would be slightly different. But every single musician is just so wonderful and knows the opera craft so well that it was, you know, at first it's a little disconcerting for a conductor because you're used to having the same group of people on at least the same program. But it you know, the personnel manager would come to my dressing room and say, well, you have a new second flute, a new principal oboe, a new principal second, new timpani player tonight. And so, okay. And just knowing that, I would make sure I got their eyes before a key, you know, moment, and it was fine.
Well, a lot of pride and congratulations on the great success there. Just a remarkable achievement. And so thank you for sharing that story.
Well, thank you.
And for sharing the story of the season of the RPO coming up here. I want to thank, first of all, my colleague from down the hall, Brenda Tremblay, who, of course, is the backbone of anything conversation we have on classical. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's always great having Brenda here. You can hear her every morning, and you should, on Classical 91.5. And producer of the RPO broadcast, Kurt Long, great meeting you here in studio. And I hope we have many more conversations. Thank you so much for being here.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
President and CEO of the RPO. And, of course, Ward, thank you. See you again. We'll see you there on stage at, with the RPO, maybe at the Met again in the future.
Sounds good.
I was going to say at the Met again. I mean, maybe again. It's Ward Stair. Our thanks to Rob Braden, who really hung in there with us all hour. Thank you, Rob. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you Friday.